welcome to Insight, live at noon with a rebroadcast at 7 p.m. Remember when Governor Newsom postponed his State of the State, an annual address that outlines his priorities for California? Well, a month later, we're still waiting. Ahead on Insight, Politico's California Playbook gets us up to speed on that, as well as the other political headlines surrounding the state capitol. Also, a new report is diving into an emerging electorate in California, young voters. The researcher joins us about the distinct differences between voters 18 to 34 compared to their elders, and ultimately how this will shape California's democracy. Finally, more than 50 local restaurants and businesses are taking part in the 14th annual Taste of East Sacramento, and we're going to get a sample of what to expect this weekend. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. That's all coming up today on Insight. First, here's the news. From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. There's lots of buzz lately around the state capitol, starting with the budget. Governor Gavin Newsom just signed an early action agreement that will slash the state's massive shortfall, which is projected to be anywhere from $38 to $73 billion. But there are still tens of billions of dollars left to cut ahead of a budget draft deadline known as the May revise, which is in just a few weeks. As the budget deficit continues to get sorted out, a key tradition in California politics has yet to take place, the State of the State address. Governor Newsom postponed the annual address, which details his priorities for the state, a month ago, following uncertainty over Prop 1, which ultimately passed by a narrow margin. And a new date has yet to be announced. Plus, there are a lot of other political headlines within just the past 24 hours. The state treasurer is involved in a federal investigation. More candidates are starting to emerge as possibilities for Governor Newsom's seat, and what was Paris Hilton doing at the state capitol? For all of that and more, we turn to Politico's California Playbook co-author, Dustin Gardner. Hey, Dustin, nice to see you again.
Hey, good to be back with you.
Well, let's start off with the State of the State address. It was announced by Politico about a month ago, March 15th, that it was going to be postponed due to uncertainty over Prop 1. Those votes have now been certified from the primary. Prop 1 has narrowly passed. What's going on with the State of the State address?
Well, really, we still don't quite know. It's been a big mystery around the state capitol. The governor has suggested that he might combine the state of the state with his May revise budget presentation. So it would be sort of a twofer where he would do both at the same time. But yeah, we haven't gotten a formal announcement on the date. The governor needs to give the legislature his updated budget by the middle of May. So we know it's going to happen at some point in the next month or so. But yeah, we're really kind of all still waiting and waiting to hear when his office is ready to revisit the canceled speech.
Yeah, it is a state of the state in California. Is it mandatory for a governor?
The governor does have to deliver a state of the state, but it doesn't have to be a speech in person. It can be in writing. He can send a letter. That has not been the tradition. You know, in modern times, generally the governor does give a speech. The governor has taken a different format in some years. Last year, for example, he did submit a speech in writing and then toured the state, you know, giving like kind of mini state of the state speeches in many different cities on some of the priority topics in his budget. So, you know, this governor does not like the traditional format, maybe the way some of his predecessors did. This is a governor who he's been very public about his struggles with dyslexia and how uncomfortable it is for him to read off a teleprompter. So he really does prefer that format that's more informal, where he can speak off the cuff. So it seems likely that he's going to want to do that when he presents his May budget. You know, that's really when this governor is in his element, when he's pointing to the slide, you know, pointing to a slideshow, talking about stats and figures and really kind of showing his wonkish side. That's much more comfortable to him than delivering a long speech off a teleprompter.
Right. And when we do have these addresses, the state of the state, I mean, yes, it outlines priorities for the state for the year, but it also is an opportunity to tout and celebrate wins that might be difficult optically, you know, at a time when a month ago, Prop 1's uncertainty, its fate was unknown. It did narrowly pass. But then also the state is facing a massive budget shortfall.
Yeah, I mean, I think from the governor's standpoint, it makes a lot of sense strategically that he wanted to wed those two things, the conversation about how, he's going to fix the deficit with his state of the state. This governor does not like but negative budget headlines. He very much tries to avoid them. He's not like Jerry Brown in the sense that Jerry his predecessor really rallied, around fixing the state's fiscal problems. Newsom has not wanted to make it, something that he's talking about every day. So yeah, I think from that standpoint, that it makes sense that the governor wants to wed these two things. And like you mentioned, Prop 1 was a very close margin, and he had been prepared to give his speech, a couple of weeks after the primary election, and it was canceled at the last minute, really, because his inner circle advisors, they were so taken aback by how close that election was. And while it ultimately passed, and it was a victory in that sense for the governor, the tightness of the margin, it was a slump for the governor, and it wasn't just a good moment, optically speaking.
Well, let's dive into the state budget a little bit. Just yesterday, Governor Newsom signed a legislative deal that will shave off about $17 billion in change, but that is even less than half of the lowest projection of the budget shortfall. I mean, the lowest projection from the Department of Finance, which is the governor's fiscal arm at the state, is $38 billion. But when it comes to the $17 billion early action plan that the governor and Democratic lawmakers have called this, what is it essentially? I mean, what are they shaving off, or are they shifting and delaying funds?
Most of this is accounting maneuvers and deferrals, deferred potential cuts. Very little of this, only about 3.6 billion, is actual firm cuts. So yeah, it's a lot of what you might call the low-hanging fruit of actions they could take to deal with the deficit. It's things like programs, school construction that has been in the budget but has been getting pushed out to future years. There's some other creative accounting maneuvers in there I think we can talk a little bit more about. But really, it's this governor saying he wants to take a big slice out of the potential red ink, and so things look a lot better when he's presenting his budget, his final May revised budget, in a couple of weeks.
Right. And it is a slice, but there's still a chunk left over to deal with. And the May revise is just a few weeks away. Do you have, I guess, what do you expect when you're talking to people at the state capitol about, what changes fiscally could come? Because there's going to have to be some big ones if you need to shave off anywhere from $38 billion to $73 billion.
Yeah, I mean, it really all depends on the revenue estimate in the governor's budget. That difference between what the legislative analysts and what the governor's Department of Finance are projecting, it's just huge. It's very unusual for there that to be that big of a difference. Let's say, for example, the estimate is closer to what the Department of Finance is projecting with the $38 billion deficit. If you take the early action that the legislature's done, and you take what they're planning to take out of reserves, Newsom and lawmakers have already agreed to take over $12 billion out of reserves. That gets you a good portion of the way to that $38 billion. But if the number comes in, $73 billion, you're talking a lot more. Tough decisions are going to have to be on the table, and this early agreement between Newsom and the Assembly and the Senate, it was the easiest things. And some of his suggested funding cuts to programs related to housing, homelessness, those were not in that package of early budget action. So those tougher discussions are going to have to come to the table. And I think really everyone in Newsom's orbit is hoping that the revenue projections are going to be a lot better in the May budget. And I will just note on that in that sense that the stock market has done much better in the first couple of months of this year than at the end of 2023. We've seen an improvement in the economy in that sense. And given our state budget is so dependent on capital gains tax from some of the wealthiest Californians who are really make a lot of their money on the stock market, that could change the picture somewhat. But we're all just kind of waiting on the edge of our seats to see what those revenue projections look like.
Yeah, and Governor Newsom, as we all know, he is rounding out his final term as governor. And Politico is reporting another big name in the Biden administration that may leave and run for California governor in 2026. That's Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra, who is the former California Attorney General, former Congress member as well in California. What do you know about that?
Yeah, so we learned last week, talking to a lot of sources and political organizers throughout the state, that Becerra and his supporters have been making calls, talking to people about, you know, him looking to get into this campaign. He would probably most likely, we're hearing, leave the Biden administration later this year to begin his run for 2026. You know, I caught up with Becerra last week when he was speaking in San Francisco at Manny's and the Mission, sort of a political watering hole for political types. And I asked him about it directly. And he, you know, he was kind of coy. And he said that because of federal law, he is a cabinet secretary. He can't be running for anything else right now. But his mother would be very happy to hear that people are considering him. And, you know, he couldn't really be candid in pointing out, you know, the restrictions he faces. But there was a really interesting moment where someone in the crowd shouted governor while he was speaking during this event. And he kind of smiled and nodded. And he also talked about during his appearance how much he missed being in California. So I think, you know, the writing's sort of on the wall. It seems like Becerra is very serious about this. But again, he would join a very crowded, very competitive field of people looking to run for governor.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. I'm like, this is a crowded race of big time Democrats. You already have Attorney General Rob Bonta, a former state Senate president, Tony Atkins, Lieutenant Governor Eleni Kounoulakis, just to name a few. What would or what could Becerra bring to this race? How does he differ from the other candidates?
I mean, I think, you know, one of the biggest things is, you know, there's a lot of Latinos in the state that want another Latino governor. It's been a long time. And he has a really strong base of support in the LA area, in the labor movement. So I think that there's a lot of people looking at him in that sense. And, you know, he's got a strong political network here. I mean, he was the former attorney general. He's now a federal level cabinet official. Becerra has his own political brand and machine in the state. And I think if he gets in, you know, that presence of a Latino candidate in a field that's already diverse, it would really shake things up and make it even more competitive than the field already is.
Yeah. Okay. Moving away from the governor's race, we have plenty of time to jump into that, mostly in, you know, 2025, when campaigns really start to ramp up. There was some big news just a few days ago that does impact Sacramento, which is obviously a political town. Governor Newsom is ordering state workers to return to the office at least 2 days a week. What do you know about that?
The governor's administration has been mulling about this for a really long time. And the initial planning we're seeing is that this would be a mandate to return 2 days per week for nearly all state employees. You know, we're talking tens of thousands of state workers. There would be some case by case exceptions for folks who have a good reason to be more remote or have personal limitations. These are things that, you know, would have to be reviewed by managers in each agency. But it was a big move, and there's been a lot of pressure from folks in Sacramento, in the capital city, who want state workers back downtown because we've seen how sluggish the recovery has been. The state owns many office buildings around K Street and around the Capitol Mall, and those neighborhoods have just really suffered. You know, every time I'm in Sacramento and I'm walking K Street, I can't help but notice how many vacant storefronts are still there. There, you know, there's little pockets that have come back, but I think that was a lot of the pressure on the administration was Sacramento officials saying we need help reviving this city, reviving this downtown.
Who's against it?
So, I mean, we've seen a lot of concerns from state workers and the labor groups representing them. Talking to friends who live in Sacramento and people who are state workers, it's all over Reddit boards and, you know, online message boards of state workers are very upset about this. And one voice that's been very pointed in the legislature is Assemblyman Josh Hoover. He's called for an audit to review this decision. And he's, you know, raising concerns that this could potentially raise costs for the state in the long term to have this many workers come back. And have the office space and all the things required. And I also point out, you know, that Hoover represents the North Sacramento suburbs. We're talking, you know, areas like Rockland and Roseville, suburbs where a lot of state workers live and people, you know, moved for a lot of them moved further out during the pandemic. And these are people that do not want to be commuting all the way from, you know, the north end of the county to an office building where they've, you know, there's a cubicle closer to the Capitol, that for a lot of them, it's not an appealing option. So it's kind of a tough clash between voices in Sacramento saying we need help to revive downtown. And then you have folks representing state workers who live further out, not wanting to make that long commute every day.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Dustin Gardner, co-author of Politico's California Playbook, about the latest in state politics. So we only have a couple minutes left, so let's do a quick roundup of other political news. It's been a busy week, or at least a busy start of the week. It's only Tuesday. Of course, the big news this week is the attack on Israel by Iran. How are California leaders responding to this?
This has really only re-emphasized the split within the Democratic Party. A lot of establishment, more moderate Democratic leaders like Governor Newsom or State Senator Scott Wiener, they've expressed their very strong ironclad support for Israel. But you have progressive leaders within the party really saying that they're concerned that once again, they feel like the response has been one-sided and that it's distracting, that the strong support being expressed for Israel is distracting from the humanitarian crisis happening in Gaza, where according to Gaza health authorities, more than 33,000 people have died. And, you know, for a while we had seen more moderate establishment Democrats be hesitant to call for a ceasefire in Gaza. And that had started to change in recent weeks. You know, we saw Newsom call for a ceasefire with conditions, and progressives in the party were cheering that. And they were saying it felt like that moderates and establishment Democrats were moving more to calling out the crisis there. But now the concern for progressives is that the response in the wake of Iran's attack on Israel, that sort of is a backslide to a position where there isn't as nuanced of a conversation about the conflict. And in their eyes, they feel like it's been too one-sided in terms of expressing support for Israel, but not continuing to call out the crisis happening in Gaza.
Yeah, and you're based in the Bay Area. Wasn't the Golden Gate Bridge shut down yesterday?
Yes, I'm based in San Francisco, and we really had a tremendous day of protests. The Golden Gate Bridge was shut down for hours. Freeway in Oakland was shut down. There were protests throughout the cities here, and these were not just brief shutdowns on these very busy bridges. You know, these went on for hours in the middle of the morning commute and really snarled traffic. People got stranded in their cars for hours. And the protesters on the bridge and on the freeway, they did things like chain themselves to vehicles. They had 55-gallon drums filled with concrete that people had chained themselves to. So it was a big mess, and it really just shows how divided people are in this region about the conflict. Mm.
Let's move over just very quickly to California State Treasurer Fiona Ma. She's involved in a federal investigation by the FBI. What do you know about that? I think it's pretty limited, but what can you tell us?
We really know very little. You know, there was some chatter on Twitter yesterday that her office confirmed that they had been asked to provide records in a federal investigation. But we don't know the subject of the investigation. And so I would really caution at this point about, you know, making any sort of conclusions about her being the target of the investigation, because from what we know, it could easily be a third party, that her office is merely providing records about a third party who's being investigated. So, yeah, I hope folks in Sacramento will take their time and let the details come out on this before we get too far ahead of the reporting.
Yeah, of course. Finally, last but not least, I mean, it's not every day you see a celebrity or a socialite, you know, roaming the halls of the state capitol building. And that happened yesterday. What was Paris Hilton doing in Sacramento testifying to lawmakers?
Yes, there was a huge amount of fanfare in the Capitol having Paris Hilton around. We've been hearing about it for weeks that she was coming. But she was here to talk about a bill that would beef up regulations on rehabilitation facilities that work with troubled teenagers. Paris herself had a rough rough teenage years, and her family sent her to that type of a facility in rural Utah. And she's spoken very publicly about, you know, the types of abuse that went on in that facility. And so she's really lending her voice to the cause here and wanting to use that trauma from her youth to help the state be a leader in beefing up more oversight and regulations and on those facilities, and really limit, you know, the way staff at those types of programs can interact with youth and the sort of physical and environmental conditions that they need to provide.
Well, I think it succeeded in, getting the attention by her making the trip to Sacramento.
Absolutely. Very much so.
Dustin, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dustin Gardner is Politico's California Playbook co-author. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio, where facts matter and stories inspire. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Primary election results have officially been certified by the state. Voter turnout was roughly 35%, which ranks at the bottom of primaries within the past 20 years. 2012 is the only year with a lower voter turnout percentage-wise. But when you break out turnout by age group, the picture drastically changes. Younger Californians have similar voter registration numbers when compared to older generations. 5.5 million ballots were mailed out to 18 to 34-year-olds for the primary. But this voting bloc had the lowest turnout of any age group. That discrepancy can really be problematic because this emerging electorate carries weight in numbers and their views don't necessarily align with their elders. A new report from the nonprofit Public Policy Institute of California, or PPIC, dives into the political views of young Californians. PPIC Senior Fellow and Policy Director Eric McGee joins us with the distinct differences among younger California voters and how that can shape the future of the state's democracy. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, Eric, let's just start from the beginning. What sparked this research? What got you interested in it?
Well, we were kind of interested in what the trying to peer a little bit into the crystal ball and see what the future of the state might hold. I mean, knowing, you know, there's lots of different ways to do that, although politics is a very uncertain business. So you can never be 100% sure. But one of the ways to do it is to just see how the future of the state as represented by its young people differs from older Californians and how that might play out over time.
Yeah, you have a good sense of hindsight when it comes to California politically. Has California always been a Democratic leaning state?
No, it really hasn't. So, you know, we have this tendency to think of California as being very Democratic and liberal. And it you know, there's been a lot of very public fights nationally recently with that as the kind of the baseline understanding. But you go back 50, 70 years, and California was a highly competitive state. And in presidential elections, it actually pretty consistently leaned Republican. So we've been on quite a political journey over that period of time. And so that kind of further prompted to us a desire to understand, okay, well, can we understand where the state might be heading in the future? And is it likely to change at all?
So 50 to 70 years, I mean, that's really not that far back when you think about it. How does the political status quo, how does it ebb and flow? How does it change over generations?
Well, in the case of our transition to being a Democratic more democratic state. There were a lot of things that transpired over that period of time. Probably one of the most significant was the large influx of immigration that happened in the 1970s and 1980s. And then at the same time, in the early 90s, we had a recession where a lot of some more conservative leaning white voters left the state because we were shutting down military production facilities, and there were a lot of cuts to defense spending at that time. And then, you know, you head into the late 90s and we had the Silicon Valley boom that brought in a different kind of worker. And there was a gradual changing around of the state's population during that period.
Yeah, and there's a lot of changes for you to look into for your latest report. Before we get started, who is a young Californian?
That's a good question. So you could define this a lot of different ways. For the purposes of this report, we say 18 to 34. We picked that because it provides that's a good cutoff for people who are kind of getting a sense of what their life is. They're getting, they're during that period of time, they're often deciding whether or not to get married. They're deciding how much education to get. They're often settling down, maybe sometimes buying their first home, although in California, that's increasingly difficult. But it's a time of kind of a little bit more uncertainty. Once you get past 35 and beyond, which we call that older Californians in the report, but I'll dump myself in that category. You get a little more settled down. You're at a different phase of your life, and maybe your perspective is a little bit different as a result. So the other thing that gives us is, we're always worried about analyzing the data as accurately as possible. And this gives us a nice, good number of people in each group so we can have statistical confidence in our results.
Yes, I'm an older Californian as well. I join you in that, Eric.
No shame in it.
No shame in it. I mean, it's only going to go up. So if
right,
we're still
exactly.
here. Anyway, so how did you actually conduct this research?
Well, so we drew on a couple different data sources. Primarily, we looked at our own statewide survey, which has been conducted in California multiple times a year for the last about 25 years. So we have a long, nice data set there that covers a broad range of time. And so most of our analysis uses that source and all the different questions about policy positions and party identification and so forth that we have in that survey. Then we also do a comparison between California and the rest of the country using a different survey that's the Cooperative Election Study, which is a rigorous academic survey. And it has slightly different questions, but allows us to do a pretty good comparison.
You touched upon some of the demographics that give us a picture of the age range of 18 to 34 in California. What other demographics are within or stood out to you within this age range?
Yeah, so you look at this younger group, and some of the biggest differences have to do with sort of their financial position in life. So they tend to be lower income. They are much less likely to be homeowners. So they are less likely to have children at home. Those are all differences that may be real and may persist over the course of their lives, but are probably going to be things that will, where the gap between younger and older will close over time to some extent. So it's just a kind of stage of life thing. But in addition to that, young people are just much more likely to be people of color. That's not news necessarily in California, but it is just worth noting again. And that's not something that's as likely to change. Certainly, people can change their conception of their own race or ethnicity, but that's not likely to change as much over time. So that's something that's more durable.
What were some of the biggest differences you saw among young California voters, 18 to 34, and people who are 35 and older?
In general, young people in California are more liberal on a wide range of policy positions. The biggest differences we see are on questions of sort of racial justice and immigration, but they do extend beyond that to kind of questions of the scope of government. So young people tend to be more supportive of government action and having a larger, more activist government in general compared to older Californians.
Hmm. I know that you mentioned that this younger California voter generation is more liberal in a state that is already thought to be liberal, at least on a national scale. What did you learn about young Californians who are registered as Republicans?
Yeah, so that's one of the most, in my opinion, one of the most interesting pieces of the report, which is the gaps between young people and old people on parties. So, you know, we are used to thinking about the parties as being very far apart from each other. Republicans and Democrats have very different opinions on a lot or wide range of policy issues. Young Democrats and young Republicans also have very big differences on these policy issues, but they are generally smaller. So across a wide range of topics, the differences are not as big, so they're not as polarized by party. And a lot of that difference is because young Republicans are more liberal on these issues than older Republicans are. They're still conservative, but they're just less conservative than the older Republicans.
There is also a big portion of registered voters who are no party preference. Were you able to look into this type of voter when it comes to that age range, 18 to 34?
Yeah, so we have them in our analysis as well. They tend to just land kind of in between, and it kind of depends on the issue which party they tilt toward more. But in California, they do tend to maybe tilt a little bit more, both for young and old, tilt a little bit more toward Democrats than toward Republicans.
How could these demographics that you laid out, that people 18 to 34 typically, you know, obviously they're younger, they're less likely to have children, less likely to be a homeowner, more likely to be lower to middle income, more likely, as you say, to be people of color. How does that shape their views on policy? Is it too simple to say that if someone was older but also met those demographics, they weren't a homeowner, they didn't have children, they are a voter of color, that they would politically have the same views as a younger Californian?
So probably not. So we didn't actually look at all of those different categories, but the one that really seemed like it might explain a lot of the differences that we saw is this question of race and ethnicity. And so we broke out our results by race, ethnicity, and found that really by and large, no, that young people are more liberal than older people of the same race and ethnicity. So you take within each racial and ethnic group, within Black Californians, Latino, Asian American, non-Hispanic white, each of those groups, the young people are generally more liberal than the older people. The differences are, they vary, and sometimes they're different for different issues. In particular, Black Californians have smaller age gaps. So there's a smaller difference between younger and older Black Californians than for other racial ethnic groups. But by and large, the same pattern holds within each of those groups.
Are there issues, regardless of age group, that California voters, they find some common ground?
Yeah, so first of all, if you ask people whether they think their taxes are fair, there's pretty good common ground there. A lot of people think their taxes aren't fair, whether they're young or they're old. Another one that's kind of interesting is abortion, where there actually isn't as much of a difference as you might expect on that question. And there's somewhere where it actually flips and goes the other way from what the kind of common public understanding is, which is that young people are actually less supportive of gun regulation than older Californians are. So it's kind of an interesting little inversion of the way that issue is normally discussed. But it does vary some across the different issues.
I think that also brings me to the question. I mean, has the meaning of party labels, has it changed over time? Does it mean something different to a young Democrat, to be a young Democrat or a young Republican compared to an older voter?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly seems like it, right? Because so you see, you look at, say, approval of Joe Biden. Young Democrats are much less approving of Joe Biden than old Democrats are. At the same time, young Republicans are more approving of Biden than older Republicans are. So there's that sort of shrinking of that party polarization that we were talking about a second ago. But that makes you think, like, well, it's okay, they both are using, you know, both the younger Californians and the older Californians are using these party labels to describe themselves, but they seem to mean something different for younger people than for older people. And it would be interesting. We didn't get into this report, like what exactly is driving that difference, but It does suggest that, you know, moving forward, it's going to be important to understand, you know, why do you call yourself a Republican? Why do you call yourself a Democrat? What is it that those labels mean to you? And maybe they mean something different than they do for older people.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Eric McGee with the Public Policy Institute of California, PPIC, about his latest report into the political views of younger Californians aged between 18 and 34 and the distinct differences that can shape the state's democracy. So if you are now a politician, you're a campaign, you are part of the party, how does this shape how you reach out to this young electorate?
Yeah, I mean, it suggests that you need to think about them a little bit differently. Now, that could mean that you want to change your positions and try and accommodate the way that they see the world. It could also mean that it's just a matter of trying to understand where they're coming from and why they take these different positions. And maybe there's some way that you can take the positions that you have now and sort of present them differently repackage them a little bit to try and accommodate the different perspectives that you're seeing among younger Californians. But I feel like as time goes on, there's going to have to be an effort made to accommodate them. And I would expect that as a result, what it means to be a Democrat or Republican in California and in the nation as a whole is going to shift over time.
People change and evolve over, you know, their lifetime. I mean, when thinking about strategy, if you're a politician or a campaign, I mean, and you use this data, aren't you making the assumption that this voter will stay the same throughout their life? Can't voters change, maybe skew more liberal or skew more conservative as they get older?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things we did in this report to try and address that issue was to use the fact that we had, you know, 20 years worth of data and see within each generation whether they changed over time. And interestingly, within California, we didn't really see a lot of evidence of that change. So within each generation, they tended to kind of stick with the level of party identification that they had for the Democrats or the Republicans, with the liberal conservative identification, with even some of the issue positions that we were able to track over that period of time, like on immigration and environmental regulation and the size of government. We then did the same thing with the national data that we had access to. And the interesting thing there is, while there wasn't really a lot of evidence of shifts, say, in liberal conservative over time within generations, you did see across pretty much every generational group, like the baby boomers and Gen X and millennials and so forth, you saw a shift toward the Republican Party nationally that you don't see in the California data. So that could be because California is just a different kind of place. It could also be because, you know, we're not looking at necessarily the same group of people over time. There's a lot of migration, people moving out, people moving in, that you don't see quite to the same extent in the national data. And so it could be that people are just, you know, as they get older, they become conservative, they decide they don't want to be in California anymore, and they move somewhere else. And then the same thing happens in reverse for people who are not in California wanting to come here. And so you get this kind of sorting process that goes on. We weren't able to answer that question definitively. So at this point, what we can really say is that we don't see a lot of evidence of that aging process that you're talking about in the data, which makes us kind of cautiously say, hey, you know, in the near future, we should probably expect these differences to persist and to become more the view of the younger Californians to become a more significant part of what it is to be Californian, because they're going to age into the electorate.
Finally, this is a different topic, but it's certainly related, and that comes down to engagement and turnout. Younger voters, that age block that you looked at, 18 to 34, I mean, they have the same weight in voter registration than older voting blocks as well. But historically, there's low voter turnout. Do you have a better understanding why younger voters have low voter turnout?
Yeah, that's a very good question. There's been, certainly that's been a consistent finding over a long period of time. And so that is one of the things that is often found is that that is an age thing, where as you grow older, you become more likely to vote. So it's not necessarily a generational difference, but it's something that changes as you get older. And you know, one of the key findings there is as you become a homeowner, you become much more likely to turn out to vote. And so one of the questions around trying to create more balance in the electorate between younger and older is to find a way to get young people to be invested in election outcomes, even if they aren't sort of rooted in their community in quite the same way that older people are. And, you know, because they maybe don't have a home, they don't think of themselves part of that neighborhood. And so they just don't become as engaged in the electoral process. But there's certainly a lot that's still at stake for them. And as we've been talking about, they have different views on all these issues. And so it would be good just from a kind of a democratic principles perspective to make sure that those views are reflected in our politics.
Eric, thanks for joining us. Interesting work.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Eric McGee is a senior fellow and policy director of the Public Policy Institute of California, discussing his latest report into the political views of younger Californians ages between 18 and 34 and the differences that they have that can ultimately shape the state's democracy. Still ahead, more than 50 local restaurants and businesses are taking part in the annual Taste of East Sacramento. We're going to get a sample of what to expect this weekend. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. If you want a large sampler platter of some of the best Sacramento has to offer when it comes to food and beverage, you are in luck. More than 50 local restaurants, wineries, and small businesses are taking part in an annual celebration that's been running for over a decade now. It's called Taste of East Sacramento, and it's going to be taking place this Saturday at the Annunciation Greek Orthodox Church off Alhambra Boulevard. Joining us now is Serena Marzion with the East Sacramento Chamber of Commerce, which presents and puts on this event, to give us a preview of what this year's Taste of East Sacramento has to offer. Good afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me, Vicky. I'm excited to talk to you about Taste.
Yes, it's perfect for lunchtime.
It really is.
Perfect timing to have this conversation. So if someone's learning about this for the first time, what is Taste of East Sacramento? How did it get started?
You know, it got started in 2003, and it was Lisa Schmidt and Josh Nelson, he's from Sellens. They got together and decided they wanted an opportunity to highlight all of the growing businesses and restaurants in East Sac. And so it started off with seven restaurants and a couple of wineries, and it's really taken off. The community has really embraced this event, and so we've just grown and grown exponentially over the years.
I would imagine just alongside with the city of Sacramento as well, over the past 14 years, when you talk about food and beverage, I mean, it must have just transformed significantly in that time for this neighborhood in East Sacramento.
Absolutely. And now we have such a wide variety of offerings. You know, you will find Indian, Thai, Italian. You know, we didn't have that years ago. And so now it's really exciting to feature such a variety of offerings that we have in our community.
And this is put on, of course, by the East Sacramento Chamber of Commerce. How many members do you have?
Our membership ranges, right now we're about 250 different businesses. And I must say, all of those are small, locally owned businesses, unlike some of the larger chambers with a big membership. So really, we get to know all of our members, and that's why we're excited to feature them at this event.
How does an event like Taste of East Sacramento help and benefit the 250 businesses that you support?
Well, not only do they have an opportunity to help us present the event, this year we have our presenting sponsor is Brickland. And so we're really featuring...
On Folsom Boulevard.
Yes, on Folsom Boulevard. And so they won't just be featuring their food, but they really have an opportunity to publicly show off what they have to offer. And but our other small businesses, you know, there are a lot of catering companies that you might not know about that will be there. And so people get a chance to talk to the chefs and the owners and really get to know what their business is about. And, you know, it's hard to try all of these restaurants over time. So it's nice to have them all in one place.
Absolutely. And I would imagine as your membership has grown and even just this event has grown from, you know, I think you said 7 vendors to now you have over 50 that's going to be happening this Saturday. The reaction and the support from the community, I would think, has grown in that same time as well.
Well, who doesn't love food and wine? You know, it's easy to have a successful event based on wonderful food and wine. But not just that, you know, we'll have a local band there playing music. You know, it really feels like a neighborhood event. Neighbors see neighbors. I see people who haven't seen each other for a year get together and have a chance to collectively meet and talk. And so it's just a really great event in terms of that.
I also think it's a treat if you get to see a local chef or a restaurant owner or an owner of a business that you don't normally get to see, but maybe you frequent regularly, but you get to see him in the flesh.
Absolutely. For instance, Hawks, you know, I know that they're there during the day a lot. And so at night at this event, people get a chance to meet Molly Hawk and her husband. And so I know that people love to see them and share with them how much they love their restaurant.
Does this actually lead or translate to a boost in business after Taste of East Sacramento?
I absolutely hope so. You know, especially some of these smaller businesses and catering companies, you know, where they don't have as much exposure as some of the bigger restaurants like Selins and Obo, who are there every year. And actually, Josh Nelson, he still helps us procure all of the different wineries because we don't have, you know, 20 different local East Sac wineries. We do have a handful, but so he goes out of the neighborhood and gets all of those for us.
What are some of the other restaurants that are going to be taking part this weekend?
Allura will be there. I'm excited to see them. Casa Isaac, which is a newer restaurant that's been really popular. La Porta, which is another new restaurant. They just opened 2 months ago. Origami, Selins, Obo, and of course, Brickland, just to name a few. But, you know, we also have some Indian food and, like I said, Thai food. So there's a lot to choose from. Nobody is going to leave this event hungry or sober.
Yes. That was my next question, which is probably important. Yeah. 21 and over?
Yes, it absolutely is a 21 and over event. We also have SABA, which is the Sacramento Area Bicycle Association. They will be providing bike valet. So we really encourage people to either Uber or our bicycle to the event. Your bike will be safe. But yeah, we will also not just have wine, but Sac Yard, who's also one of our sponsors, they'll be providing a beer garden area. Nitty Cider will be there. Baker Family Wines, which is owned by Dusty Baker. He might be making an appearance, I hear. So that's kind of exciting news. But we have a few non-alcohol. Temple Coffee will be there. So we do have that option as well.
That is awesome. If you have a ticket, you're going to buy a ticket. Does that basically give you pretty much a full pass
yes.
to just try everything?
Yes, I don't want you to have to get out your wallet. Once you're there, your hands are going to be full with a plate and a glass. So yes, once you purchase your tickets, they're $85. We still have a few left. You can purchase at tasteofeastsac.com. But once you're in, yes, beer, wine, beverages, and lots of food.
How many people are you expecting?
We are expecting 600 people this year. So yes, we have grown quite a bit since when I started doing the event 8 years ago, it was a 100-person event. So yes, we've grown quite a bit. And we have opened up the space so that now we're indoor, outdoor, and included lots more seating. So that was another thing that we've seen over the years, that people want to be able to sit and relax a bit while they eat and drink.
Yeah, it's a good group of people.
It is.
Getting together. And you've sold out in the past, right?
Every year we sold out, and we expect to sell out again this year.
So if you can give us a little bit of advice, if this is your first time, I mean, over 50 restaurants and wineries sounds amazing. That can also feel a little overwhelming.
Yes.
How do you recommend someone navigate their way around Taste of East Sacramento?
Pace yourself. It is, the event goes from 6 to 9. And so, yeah, I would pace yourself, but definitely come hungry and definitely Uber. But yeah, just take the opportunity to talk to the different folks there. Don't just grab a piece of food, but talk to them, get to know some of these chefs. The winemakers are there. They love to talk about their wines, and they have multiple different tastings. And so, it's just for me, it's always great to go to a dinner party and say, hey, this wine is from this particular winery, and this is what I know about it. So it's fun to learn things about the different restaurants and wineries.
If people miss this one on Saturday, what other events is the Chamber putting on?
Well, we have quite a few different events coming up. Another thing that we do in August is called Savor East Sac, and that is an opportunity for you to go back to all of these different restaurants, and they'll have a special going on for 10 days. And so that's the thing about this event, is it helps fundraise so that we can do things for our members like Savor East Sac. And then we also have Shop East Sac in December. So all of these are promotions for us to try and encourage people to shop, eat, and play local in East Sacramento.
I would think sometimes during the winter or even during that summer heat in August, does business go down around that time?
It does. And so that's why in August, that we found from our restaurateurs, August is a slower month. People are traveling or they're getting the kids back into school. And so that's why we've chosen to do Savory Sack in August.
Serena, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you so much for having me.
Serena Marzion is the executive director of the East Sacramento Chamber of Commerce. And we have been talking about the 2024. It's the 14th annual Taste of East Sacramento. It is happening this Saturday in East Sacramento, Saturday evening, and we have more information to tickets and information on our Insight page. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. And if you want to reach out to us, send us an email, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer and audio engineer is Chris Feltz. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. And our original show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great Tuesday. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.